Hello everyone, welcome to the Mobilize podcast. I'm David Lytle, and today I'm speaking with Nick Headley. Nick Headley runs the Progress Playbook, and we're going to be talking about the kind of news they cover, a little bit about what's happening with the transition in South Africa, the systems that aren't working. But with all that said, let's jump into it.
That is the equivalent of 10 nuclear reactors, or 10 large coal plants. Traditional media, I think, puts too much emphasis on diversity of voices for the sake of it. Thank you very much for having me, David. Good to be here. Yeah, my name is Nick Headley. I am the founder of the Progress Playbook, which is a journal focused on climate and sustainable development solutions from around the world. Also a columnist for News 24 and work a little bit in the solar industry.
I didn't realize you worked in the solar industry. What do you sort of do in that, out of curiosity?
A recent thing. I've been doing financial modeling for a solar energy startup. We are doing solar installations for low-income schools.
Oh, very cool. And is it sort of grant-funded, or is it sort of a thing where it pays for itself sort of model?
So the idea is to make a sustainable financial model. And unfortunately, the problem with a lot of grant-funded solutions is that they actually end up not being sustainable. As soon as sort of grant funding runs dry, there's no money left for maintenance, and there's no money to, you know, build the next solar installation for a school. So it is, the idea is to create a sort of financially sustainable entity that schools can help fund the next one and the next one and the next one.
So yeah, basically it's the economics of climate change, right? Or climate mitigation and adaptation, where it's not just good enough that we have the technology, we need to be able to viably deploy it.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think when government's not involved, government can potentially absorb a loss, but the rest of society can't really, particularly, as you said, low-income schools.
Exactly. I think government has a responsibility to help kind of de-risk the projects that are in underserved communities, which, you know, the traditional clean energy developers avoid the underserved communities because they're riskier, people struggle to pay, the economics don't really stack up. So governments do have a responsibility to step in and help de-risk projects and create a kind of enabling environment.
That makes a lot of sense. It's interesting you say de-risking, because I know particularly in the space in which we talk about how to reform the financial elements around climate change, de-risking is quite controversial. It's often viewed as a way that sort of gives money to private business but doesn't actually meaningfully lead to higher performance. But what I'm hearing from you is that we're not talking about a big business here. We're not talking about a mega corporation like your sort of Totals of the world or your Shells or something. We're talking about a small business. So do you want to just dive into de-risking for me a little bit? And I'm sure you're familiar with the controversiality or controversialness of de-risking.
Oh, 100%. To be honest, I think it's a tricky one. I think it will remain a kind of unjust transition for as long as there aren't these kind of mechanisms in place to help the private sector and NGOs and others to serve underserved communities. And that does require, I think, an element of de-risking. It's a bit of a double-edged sword, like you say. De-risking, that word can kind of help bad actors as well. But I do think it is necessary.
So are there, in the sort of work you're doing and talking about, how much have you delved into de-risking and sort of the impacts of it? Is it something that you guys have looked at closely in terms of how, well, when I say you, I'm referring to the Progress Playbook at the moment. Is it something you've ever dived into? Or is it, it's something more that you're only discovering now that you're sort of working in the solar industry to some degree?
I think, to be honest, it's something I've kind of been keeping an eye on. I think in the system that we are currently working in, it is absolutely critical. Okay. Once we've kind of, if we ever manage to break out of the kind of, you know, capitalist world that we live in, then hopefully these kind of mechanisms won't be needed. But this, unfortunately, is the reality, the kind of paradigm in which we are operating. And in a world where we don't, you know, take into account externalities of fossil fuels and things like that, we're not operating in a perfect system.
I think this is a good time for us to get back on topic, because we totally got distracted by talking about those solar projects. So what is the progress plan? What I know this has been going for 3 years?
About 2 years.
2 years.
Okay. Coming up 2 years.
What is the intent of it? What is it? How can our viewers and listeners interact with it? You want to just give a quick synopsis?
So it is a journal focused on climate and sustainable development solutions from around the world. So basically what we do is kind of scour the globe for pockets of real progress, with the idea of showing what is possible in any kind of any sphere of sustainable development. So whether that's tackling climate change, reducing poverty, increasing access to quality education, we're looking around the world for pockets of genuine real progress with data to prove it, to show what's possible, to kind of shut down arguments that we can't shift to clean energy, it doesn't work, and we can't, you know, provide access to equal access to quality education, things like that. We're trying to shut down those arguments, which a lot of politicians use to kind of maintain the status quo. Firstly, show what's possible, and secondly, show how. So what were the kind of policies and strategies behind those success stories, with the idea being to create a kind of comprehensive blueprint of best practices from around the world that leaders everywhere can follow if they genuinely want to advance the kind of UN SDGs.
The SDGs. I think we'll make sure we link to what those are so we can inform our listeners or viewers. So if you're watching on YouTube, there should be a link that pops up now. What's fascinating to me is you're talking about you mentioned that part of who you're trying to convince are leaders. There are people running governments, et cetera, et cetera. My understanding is that's not the primary audience. So the primary audience is more, should we say, sort of middle-class, interested individuals, but not necessarily active. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. We do actually have a lot of policymakers from around the world who are regular readers, but the bulk of the audience is just people who are interested. And that is equally as important, because we want to inform people so that they can hold their leaders to account. So if people know what's possible and know how the leaders are faring in sustainable development, they can demand the same in their own countries.
So it's like, if I think of the green hydrogen conversation, in principle, everything about green hydrogen sounds fine.
Yeah.
But if we go and invest, if we borrow money and invest billions in building out green hydrogen infrastructure, and then no one wants to buy it from us, we're screwed.
Yeah.
Which
is going to be the case.
At the moment, that's what it looks like. So, but when de-risking in that environment could be signing a trade contract with like a big country like Germany to commit to buy a certain quantity of hydrogen from us at a certain rate for 30 years.
Yeah.
That kind of de-risking, I think, makes a lot of sense. We should be de-risked because as a nation state, for us to invest dramatically in this industry. But when de-risking is like, cool, we'll give you a massive tax subsidy to go and do a project you probably were already going to do.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, what a lot of, you know, and then they still are entitled to their 15-20% profit margin. Whereas like, cool, maybe we agree to de-risking, but then the profit margin is...
I hate our economic system, but like, there is always a trade-off.
Well, I think that's the sort of idea is work is a demonstration of energy, right? It's what we've done. That is what work is. Mm. Or the currency is a demonstration of work or whatever. I don't remember the right language for this right now.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, something being free is paid for by some work somewhere.
Yeah.
Now, we can talk about how efficient we are as a society, and that means we produce such a surplus of work, we can actually get certain things for free, so to speak, because they're just basically byproducts of our incredible efficiency. At the same time, there's this huge gap with the inequalities created, which means the last 20 years, we've actually no longer benefited from any improvements in efficiency, it's all gone to your top 100% of society.
Exactly.
There's that Johnny Harris video I was talking about. Like, yeah, it's such a good example because it shows. Yeah, it shows it. It sort of shows how, look, it's a look at America, but it's basically a global phenomenon where
America is the very worst of it, though.
They're pretty bad. But it basically shows that, you know, the 80s economic policies that were instituted by your Thatchers, Reagans, and sort of the Anglophone world, but other politicians in other countries, basically resulted in a flatlining of middle class wealth, and it resulted in a decrease in the wealth of low-income individuals.
Yes.
While at the same time, property prices and a whole bunch of normal costs of living have continued to go up.
Yep.
Which has effectively made people poorer.
Yeah, and I think AI is going to accelerate that.
I suspect with what we've been talking about now is actually going to end up in the podcast. But
I think AI is going to massively accelerate that. Any knowledge-based job is at risk. Anything that requires knowledge. Knowledge is worth zero now.
When you say knowledge, are you referring to sort of thoughts on paper, like intellectual property? You're not referring to sort of the coming up of ideas, but you're referring to sort of the... So you say then, like, LLMs, your sort of large language models, are... Okay, so I would say from some university professors I've spoken to that it is replacing some critical thinking students need to be participating in, but I wouldn't say it's better than our critical thinking.
Not yet, but a year or two will be vastly different.
Oh, I'll happily take a bet on that. There was definitely something we can link below, or we can try and find below and link for the audience, is a conversation about how AI actually works and that it fundamentally lacks creativity. It's kind of like algorithmic randomness in generating responses to stuff, which is quite impressive. Don't get me wrong.
That is how human brains work as well.
The argument's how great is it? That's not how the human brain works. So, but anyway, I guess it's something we'll see. And I'm very keen for us to dive into a discussion about artificial intelligence because of the sort of economic disruption effect it has.
So I think the difference there is that LLMs are, like you say, they kind of, you prompt them and they'll give you some kind of random output. But agentic AI is the one, the sort of next phase of AI, which is starting and very quickly. Oh, yeah. Agentic, so agents.
Okay, I've never heard that term before.
And they can take initiative and plan and kind of equivalent of a human. And that's already kind of being rolled out.
I'm fascinated to see where that goes because I think there's a few points there, right? There's a point about our economic system. And typically, before we get too distracted, to connect this to climate change, I think a conversation that's happening more and more in the think tanks and advocacy groups and journalists covering this issue is that climate change is a symptom of our economic system.
Absolutely.
It's a symptom of the fact that we are not charging the costs of climate change to the people participating and creating it. We're just saying somehow governments or people are just going to have to deal with it. We're not actually saying you face the consequence of climate change, you are paid by the people causing it. And what this has meant is there's a huge financial incentive for your sort of super corporations to just emit. And the costs are essentially socialized by global governments. So when we talk about these issues like generalized AI or agentic AI, as you just said, they do actually link because it's the same economic system. And there's an even closer link in the energy consumption of AI. I don't know if you want to talk to that quickly.
Energy consumption of AI. Yeah, I mean, it's a year ago before the AI boom really got going, it looked like we were kind of on the cusp of quite a rapid shift away from fossil fuels. Now that we are looking at AI data centers that consume 10 gigawatts of power for a single mega data center, we are No. So 10 gigawatts as kind of maximum draw, instantaneous.
Could you put that into context about how much energy that is? Like, how many houses or how many South Africans does that power?
That is the equivalent of 10 nuclear reactors or 10 large coal plants. And it is, so South Africa's peak energy consumption, peak demand is about 28 gigawatts. So it is about a third of the very most that South Africa uses at any given time. Say, for example, an evening in the middle of winter, that is just a single data center will use a third of what we use at our very worst.
I think that's very, very demonstrative. And I think this opens questions about global inequality, because while these, well, huge amounts of energy and at times not clean energy, I know this, I remember hearing or reading articles about pushes for data centers to be paired with large renewable and or other low carbon intensity energy. But the reality is data centers are going up faster than that energy source is coming online. And if I understand correctly, what this means is that when they were planning on turning off a coal power plant or a gas power plant or some carbon emitting power plant, they delay that because of the increased demand. All the while, people in some parts of the world, including South Africa, don't have access to electricity to cook, to heat, to use the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the latest projections are AI or data centers will consume about 12% of America's electricity within the next couple of years, which is massive. That is just a mind-blowing number. Within a few years, to have suddenly gone from almost zero to 12% is massive. And that what that means is a lot of old thermal power stations will stay online because the grid is getting really stretched. And kind of with the Trumps of the world saying just throw every energy source you can at it, just build whatever. It means a lot of new gas in particular will be built to help power data centers. There's also mega strain. Data centers are very water intensive. There's also huge strain on water systems. The AI industry is selling it as a, well, this will kind of be netted off by AI helping our energy systems become a lot more efficient, which there's a little merit to. AI can help with things like balancing power grids and making the system more efficient to ultimately use less electricity, but they very much have an incentive to pitch it that way. And it's not likely that they'll be able to kind of net off the huge surge in computing power and energy needs that is needed.
Well, I think even if you look at South Africa, could we, through efficiency, decrease our demand by one third?
No.
So, and granted, that 10 gigawatts obviously serves a larger population and South Africa's population. It serves, I suppose, a large portion of the global population. But I think those risks you're describing are very appropriate. And talking about the systemic risk of the economic system, there is not really a financial incentive for them to force to wait for renewables to replace. And it interrupts the process of renewables replacing existing thermal plants. Also, for our listeners, would you like to explain what a thermal power plant is? What's different from it from other kinds of power plants?
Yeah, it's a traditional power plant where you basically burn something and create steam that turns a turbine. Old school power, so coal and gas mainly.
Technically, nuclear is also like that, right?
Yeah.
But obviously, nuclear is controversial in its own right for many reasons, but it's in terms of you're not burning a fuel. I don't know how you're consuming a fuel, but in a way that doesn't create carbon emissions through the process, at least.
Yeah.
Whereas renewables, like wind, uses the wind to turn a turbine instead of steam. Exactly. Solar, photovoltaic. Well, I suppose there are thermal solar power plants, hey?
They are. CSP, concentrated solar power, is kind of acts in a similar way. Not quite entirely sure how to explain it.
we'll get on someone to explain how PV panels work at some point. But long story short, it's very, very different. The one upside I've heard about CSP, which is where I think you still have proponents of it, is that molten salts can be stored in a thermos, basically, for a few days.
Yeah.
Which means that you can design one of those power plants to basically give power when we have a shortage from a combination of our other renewables.
Yeah.
Which is why I think it's still interesting as an option. Albeit it's also the other issue with it is while renewables obviously don't have the carbon emissions, concentrated solar power can have quite intense environmental consequences, much like a large hydroelectric, in that bird life can be deeply harmed by it because these beams of like high temperature light and they can get fried flying through it.
To be quite honest, every single energy source has environmental consequences. I think that is something that everyone on both sides of the spectrum pretends their preferred power source does not. Every single power source has some kind of environmental consequences, including solar PV. But obviously at a much lesser scale.
And potentially more manageable, right?
Yeah.
So I think of one of the things about your environmental harm from renewables, they're not just dumped into the atmosphere in the same way.
Yeah.
So if effectively what we're doing with all our thermal power plants is it's kind of like putting poison in a river constantly. Sometimes we literally do that, but that's how those work. Whereas with the waste from the production of renewables, you can actually manage it and mitigate it.
Absolutely. But I think, just taking one step back.
Sure.
I think that's why energy efficiency is one of the sort of unsung heroes of the energy transition and is very much overlooked.
Yeah.
We need to use only clean energy, of course, but we need to also use as little energy as we possibly can.
Yeah.
I think there was a study by University of Stellenbosch recently that said, if we just changed all of our incandescent light bulbs, so the old ones that use a lot of resistance,
they generate huge heat, which is high.
Exactly.
That's actually the wasted energy. It's the heat you're feeling.
Exactly. If we just replaced all of those with LED bulbs, that would be the equivalent of two stages of load shedding or something.
When was that research undertaken? Because I know there's, if I just think of the last 5 years, there's been a huge switch already. And, every year, I think people do switch over to LEDs when they buy replacement bulbs.
There has been, but there's a very long way to go. And it's just one kind of small example of energy efficiency that, I mean, there's one thing that always kind of blows my mind is when you drive between Stellenbosch and Cape Town and a lot of places in Joburg as well, every street light is on during the middle of the day. And that is apparently because of a theft problem. But it just kind of goes to show how we're just completely wasting energy all the time.
Did you just suggest that dealing with crime reduces high energy consumption? No, but I suppose this is the intersectionality, the connection of issues, right? What you just got onto is that things are all very connected. We do things for a reason. I think what you described is the same reason that they used to, I don't know if it's still the case, but a lot of stores would leave on their lights at night.
Yeah,
to prevent crime as well.
Yeah.
And then these are sort of, I think of houses, the house I grew up, my parents would always leave the lights on at night, or the outdoor lights, so that, it would prevent crime.
Electric fences.
Yeah, sure. It's interesting. There's also, we can try and find a video to share with our listeners about this, but one of the, often when people try and naysay renewables, well, we have to replace 50 gigawatts of power. But with the efficiency you're talking about, a big part of carbon emissions is not from electricity-based sources. And switching those sources to electricity makes big savings. I've heard a big thing about if you were to just take petrol and diesel, burn it in a thermal power plant, and use that to power an electric car, you emit less for the energy you're producing. Do you sort of have an insight into that you want to share with why that's the case?
I think Sorry, I'm going on a bit of a tangent, but you made me think of something here. Is just if you look at our global shipping industry, more than one third of ships crossing the world are just carrying fossil fuels. So once we've once we've electrified things, shipping is one of the biggest sources of carbon emissions. Yeah. Well, not one of the biggest, but it's a very big source of carbon emissions. Once we've electrified things and stopped just burning things for heat to, you know, power our industries and things like that, that is already a third of shipping gone instantly like that.
And critically, that will help fisheries, right? It'll make fisheries, because the environmental consequences of shipping is not just the emissions.
Yeah.
It's also the huge amounts of leaking happening.
Yeah.
So yeah, that shipping example is so powerful. Other ones are like, you know, I just think of cooking on your stove. Before we even talk about, I imagine much of our audience will know about your sort of traditional electric stove, and then you get these new ones, which are, what are they called?
Induction,
which use basically they heat the pot rather than heat the stove top, which in part, but even just your normal electric stoves, your sort of resistance-based heating versus a gas stove top is way energy efficient.
Yeah.
Once again, and the thing you talked about, okay, so we're using gas in our house to cook, which I think understandably many South Africans have switched to because of our energy crisis, but just the process of, once again, bringing the gas from a site to a distribution point in Johannesburg uses energy. Every time we refill one of those gas canisters, a percentage is leaked. If all we do, which is not all we need to do, to clarify, we're not being pro-gas and saying this, but if all we do is we send that gas to a thermal power plant, burn it there, and then use that to heat either a resistive plate or ideally an induction plate, that would save huge energy as well. And there is research that's been done on this. And like I said, we'll try and find a video to share with the audience or a podcast to share with the audience about this. But we don't actually need to produce the entire amount of energy we're currently producing with fossil fuels, because basically we only need to produce half if we're being more efficient, I think it was what people thought about 10 years ago when it came to sort of energy efficiency, but it's not really what people think about today.
I think one step further there is there's no need to even, you can sort of cut out the middleman there and just create electricity from your roof that powers your induction stove. Nothing needs to be transported anyway. You don't need to mine something in America, ship it across the ocean and re-gasify it and then put it into a power plant, and then that powers your stove. You can just take it literally directly from your roof. And the world can get, there's a couple of differing studies on this, but close to kind of half of our energy needs can actually just come from our roofs.
Particularly in a country like South Africa.
Exactly.
And particularly in a city like Johannesburg.
Yeah.
It's really underestimated in that, one, we have short winters, but two, once again, a city like Johannesburg, we have generally clear skies in winter, which means when we're getting when we're getting less output, we're getting more output in the day than actually your rainy summers.
So Sydney in Australia is basically working to become energy independent just using its rooftops and batteries and virtual power plants. Okay. And
do you want to explain a virtual power plant to the audience quickly?
Sure. There's a couple of different sort of ways they can be used, but the ways that have been used in Australia and Texas and places like that is a power producer will aggregate, say, 1,000 homes who each have their own rooftop solar and battery installations, and use that to respond to what the grid needs. So if the grid suddenly needs a little injection of power, it aggregates these 1,000 homes into their own sort of mini ESCOM power plant and will inject that into the grid. When conversely, on the other side of things, when demand is low, it can kind of throttle back that energy from those homes or shift demand around. So if the system is tight in the evening, it will automatically, you know, kind of preheat your home when there's abundant energy earlier in the day.
I feel like this connects to that AI conversation we were having in terms of that sort of stuff, right? That's the efficiency they mean by AI being able to work these things out.
Exactly. That is another kind of form of energy efficiency, is using it when energy is abundant and cheap, and taking strain off the grid when energy is expensive and in short supply.
And practically how that looks, right, is effectively is for people that have batteries and solar panels, they're connected to the grid, they're selling electricity to the grid, but all their batteries combined are sort of brought together into one giant mega battery in a sense, right?
Exactly.
That's what you're talking about, aggregation.
Yeah. So this is something, obviously, that utilities everywhere are kind of resisting, the decentralization of energy, where every household, every community kind of has the opportunity to become their own energy supplier and energy producer that sells into the grid. There is naturally a lot of resistance, including in South Africa, from utilities seeking to sort of maintain their monopolies.
What would you say that's about? Is it about because they're anxious about their, so South Africa, there is a monopoly.
Yeah.
Would you say is that like the primary reason why why we don't have, I think what this is called is, what do we call it when the grid purchases back power from a wheeling?
That's the feed-in tariffs and wheeling.
Yeah, feed-in. So would you say the main reason we don't have feed-in tariffs and wheeling yet is that, or is there other reasons?
Eskom has really resisted, as has the national government, because it sees a threat to Eskom, which is a threat to the country. If Eskom fails, that is a huge burden on the fiscus, and jobs lost. It's kind of understandable, but it is really holding back progress. So one thing, for example, South Africa has an opportunity to create energy communities and low-income communities where, you could use going back to my example, a school as a sort of hub of energy for a community. Yeah. And everyone in that community can buy very cheap power from the school. But we're not really creating those opportunities because this is all a risk to Eskom. And this, the same story is playing out across the world.
I feel like we could have a really deep dive into how politics get involved in systems and influence them. But what I want to sort of do is zoom out for a second and look at sort of the bigger picture, which is what we're discussing is kind of what an article on the Progress Playbook does, right? You explain an issue, you pull out data, like the 10 gigawatts, you show examples, you talk about Sydney, we talked about Scotland earlier. And you take these examples and you tell the story and you create the narrative, I suppose, of how we actually get to the place we need to be. I know before this, we started the podcast, I remember us having a conversation about positivity, and that the Progress Playbook is basically, you're trying to show these are the pathways. But internally, it sometimes feels a bit overwhelming. I think, do you want to talk about, but you talked about the holding leaders accountable earlier and we kind of got distracted and moved on. But what is the sort of theory of why the journalistic work you and the Progress Playbook team does, how does it actually change things? Why does people engaging with articles you produce, how does it change the world? How does it lead to these changes that you're advocating for?
So I think one of the main reasons people are defecting from news and traditional media is we are just completely overburdened with negative news and people are starting to tune out. There's just too much information out there, too much of it is negative, and it's deeply overwhelming, and people feel they can't, what's the counterpoint, because I can't really change anything. So I think that is starting to give rise to solutions journalism, which hasn't really actually taken off in South Africa yet, I think, and I hope it will, which is a kind of new form of journalism that is focused on solutions to all of these problems that we understand, but we feel kind of we have no agency over. I think once you've armed people with the information about how we actually deal with these problems rather than just reporting and how dire everything is, people are able to demand that of their political leaders, of business leaders, and of civil society groups. It gives people kind of more agency and helps them re-engage in news, which the business model there is really struggling. And I do think it's partly, at least partly, a self-inflicted issue.
I think that makes sense. It's, I think complex issues are never down to one person's actions or one entity's actions. It's usually a system response. What really is fascinating is I remember learning about this. One of my teachers explained this to me in like grade five. A long time ago, prep school, about come to me with solutions, not problems. And the idea is that don't just wallow in the problem. Start thinking about how you can fix it because it is fixable. Mm. And then it reminds me of another line of like, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah.
And I think that's that response in journalism to just talk about the crisis and make everyone anxious all the time has led to that, as you said, how do you describe it? The opting out. So that people opt out of news. And then that in turn, I wonder how, if we were to take studies of people from the 1980s and we look at people now, how much are they aware of general societal problems and their role in repairing them or fixing them or how they can change them, be it electorally, be it through some sort of mass action, be it through, you know, using financial means that voting with your wallet sort of idea. So there's been quite a drop in that from the 80s, is my understanding, that engagement with news. And if what I'm hearing you say is that basically part of the solution to that problem is that news needs to talk slightly differently about the problems we face.
Yeah, I think so. I think also one thing from, say, the 80s, to use your example, is news was a lot more local, mm-hmm. so people could take local action. Now our news, the world has got so much smaller, and we are constantly bombarded with what's going on in the East, what's going on in the Middle East, and just feel totally overwhelmed and a lot less focused on our own communities and our own, what we can actually do locally. And I think it's just complete information overload and bad news overload, and people just kind of roll over and give up. And I think solutions journalism can help to solve that.
So we have this problem that people don't know the solutions because they're not engaging with media. And one of your solutions to that is the way we talk as media entities. Are there any other ones that come to mind that our listeners can maybe contribute towards that they can assist in changing the information environment, changing the understanding of how they can change the world? What can they do practically today? So I think this is a good space where we used to pay for news.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying we should pay for bad news. Like, we shouldn't reward bad news behavior where it's not helpful, where it's if it bleeds, it leads. But you were saying that local news used to be much stronger, much more present. Mm. Something I think the audience can do is, you know, maybe instead of, and I'm talking here to sort of people who can afford to go out for coffee in a coffee shop twice a week, you know, maybe don't go to coffee shop once a month and instead subscribe to a local news source. Mm. Even if you're not 100% sure of it yet, just that process of participating with your finances in good information. Anyone who sort of follows the news industry in South Africa would know that literally every year for the last, since I can remember, since I became an adult, I think, we've seen news organizations close in this country.
Yeah.
And not because another one grew up to replace them and there was competition, but because there just was less and less and less money. But yeah, I think that's the top one that comes to mind, is we actually need to resource good information.
Yeah, I do think actually people now have a little more control over the news that they can consume. I think this started with, say, Twitter sort of democratizing access to information before Twitter became a hell. And I think the latest sort of iteration of that is the Substacks of the world, which people can now curate their own news. So if I would like climate news, I'll subscribe to this newsletter for my business news, I'll subscribe to this one. So it's no longer just I subscribe to the Financial Times and I'll take whatever they whatever they give me.
So the curation is yours.
Exactly. I can now curate exactly what I like. And that also allows you to support local news. As well as this kind of new brand of solutions journalism, which is definitely growing. So I think massive risk to, again, traditional media has gone through 10 years of hell with social media and the switch to digital. This is unfortunately just making things even worse, because now people have a lot more control over where they get the information and curating their perfect curation of who they would like to listen to. And it's now actually less about big news brands and more about personalities. And I trust this voice and I'll follow him or her for my business news. I trust this voice and I'll follow them for climate news and energy news.
Which I suppose on one hand, it's great. You know, you don't have to support stuff you don't got like that you think is garbage. It's, on the other hand,
exactly.
There's a downside. Echo chambers, right?
Exactly. There's a big downside. We have cognitive bias is one of the biggest challenges in the world. Mm. We all have our sort of preconceived ideas of how things, myself included, everyone, and this applies to absolutely everyone, we have our preconceived ideas of the world and we look for people who reinforce that. So we will subscribe naturally to someone who tells me exactly what I want to hear because it's reinforcing my ideas. And I think we do actually have a responsibility to try and subscribe to and listen to voices that are at least acting in good faith and not intentionally trying to mislead, but that challenge our views.
What I really like about what you're saying there is we're not saying, I suppose, to people who want to change the world, we're not saying go and give money to an entity that's putting up nonsense, right? But we are saying try and listen to some stuff and then the good content you're engaging with should also be able to give you the answers. Mm. So someone asked a question, while bad intent, maybe, I think this is very obvious in the way a lot of the fossil fuel companies, they're just asking questions. But once again, they could actually answer those. And I think this is where organizations or entities like the Progress Playbook comes in. And look, this podcast is not an advertisement for Progress Playbook, but it's one of many new media institutions in South Africa that I think are trying to deal with this. Other ones that come to mind, which we really would encourage the audience to check out, is Oxpeckers. They're really good at this. They have an old power tracker.
Very good. Data collection as well.
And what they do is when you see this question come up, which is, it's fine. You know, it's reasonable to expect an answer to a question irrespective of the source. Oxpeckers will give you the answer. Progress Playbook will give you the answer. The Conversation South Africa will give you a good answer. Ground Up gives good answers as well. And even some of our traditional media, which annoys the heck out of us at times, does as well. But I suppose then to get to that story, what can our listeners do if they want to combat climate change? One of the things they need to do is participate in creating better media in South Africa by insisting good quality editorializing, which is that selection of good sources. But also in that article should be less about if it bleeds, it leads, and be more about this is the problem, these are the solutions, these are what you can try and do to contribute towards these solutions.
Yep. And I think if we put too much, traditional media, I think, puts too much emphasis on diversity of voices for the sake of it. And just hear me out, yeah. As soon as I said that, I could hear how that could maybe be misinterpreted. For example, Business Day, who I used to write for, has given a column to people like Bjorn Lomborg, who's a climate change denier.
Oh, right.
Purely because they are trying to show both sides. Whereas I don't think showing both sides for the sake of it, even at the expense of what is true, is the right way to go. And I think that's where a lot of media houses have got things wrong.
Well, let's play with that for a second, right? Because one of the things we're saying is we don't want to try and silence things. Mm. But climate change, look, we can have conversations about how much of a risk climate change is to us. And I think very wealthy individuals would say, well, I can just get air conditioners. I can just change my house. I can afford some more expensive food. So sure, those are conversations. I would say we can have differences of opinions on that. I obviously have a strong one myself. But things like, are carbon emissions causing climate change? That's not a debate anymore.
Exactly.
We know that. So what could business day do instead, would you say? I don't think we want to do this thing where we give voice to people which are spreading misinformation, which it sounds like this guy is doing. But how do we respond to that? Because I think there is a requirement to respond to that.
I think I'm not saying cancel voices. I actually think that is a bad strategy, but yeah. You are supposed to be a gatekeeper of the truth.
Yeah.
So by all means, publish a piece by Bjorn Lomborg, but fact check it.
Right.
And make sure that because you're offering someone a platform, you're not just allowing them to spew misinformation.
You know what this reminds me of is when I was young, I have not looked at a physical newspaper in a very long time, but you'd often have letters to the editor, which are kind of like op-eds from members of the community. And then the editor would often respond. Like, we don't have to pay for misinformation. If they want to, because they're probably, honestly, if they're spreading that kind of misinformation, willing to bet that they're probably being funded by someone to spread that kind of misinformation is my bet. They've got an economic model behind Verity. A truth-telling organization does not need to financially support them to spread those messages.
Yeah.
But sure, don't de-platform them. De-platform them. Don't prevent them from communicating.
Agreed.
But always have a robust response. So say, cool, you know, you're going through the article and suddenly this one line in the article is highlighted. And if you click on it, it says, this is just not true. Like, yes. This is how they misframed the thing.
I could not agree more. I do think the sort of cancel culture of canceling voices you disagree with, it has actually, is partly what's given rise to the Trumps of the world.
Sure.
So I don't think that is the answer, but I do think, so one thing traditional media has done to sort of remain relevant in news has become very democratized. You can get all your news on Twitter, for example. Sure. What they've done is lean quite heavily on opinion. Yeah. So they have a couple of high-profile opinionists who they rely on to still maintain a reader base.
Yes.
But they confuse diversity of opinion with, okay, well, you can say anything. Doesn't matter if it's true or not. No one fact-checks columnists and opinion writers.
Yeah.
I'm a columnist. I don't get fact-checked, and that really annoys me. I should. There should be someone saying, okay, actually, hold on, you've got this wrong. Because
I just have to respond to that.
Yeah.
So Immobilize, you know, we're an advocacy organization. We're trying to change the world. We're not journalists. We fact check ourselves.
Yeah.
We have an internal, this is what the editor's supposed to do, right?
Mm.
And you're saying this is basically being dropped from opinion.
The world over, it's not a South African problem. Everywhere traditional media allows opinion writers and columnists to say whatever they want, and it's not fact-checked. And that I see this all the time in opinion pieces and columns where someone will sort of make a wild claim that is objectively untrue. So, for example, again, another Business Day columnist. I hate that I'm being, this is my old employer, but...
yeah, bad mouthing your former employer.
Exactly. But another Business Day columnist, I won't mention her name, but she very frequently will write about, for example, how Europe has abandoned the energy transition and started building new coal plants, which is just entirely untrue. And that's not fact-checked. It's just published as is. And this is just, it's just misleading. The whole kind of point of journalism was to be a gatekeeper of reliable information. And now that we are leaning very heavily on opinion to maintain readers, we've kind of let that completely go.
Yours and your colleagues are trying to fix these media issues. You're creating a platform for that.
In a way, there's still obviously a role. So we are entirely solutions focused. There's still, of course, a role for just hard news media and opinion media and all of that, as long as it's fact checked. We're just a different, we're just a slightly different take of things. Just one part of the puzzle, one part of the pie.
Yeah.
I think one thing that it's kind of born out of is it's always annoyed me that we'll have these G20 summits and and we'll have UN summits every year and none of the countries kind of get together and say, hey, Norway, you've done really well with electric vehicles. How did you manage that? What can we learn from you? Or, hey, Uruguay, you're on 100% on renewable electricity. What policies did you put in place to get there while sort of cushioning people in the fossil fuel industry, cushioning the blow from the shift along the way? Yeah. We're not, world leaders are not learning from each other. So there needs to be some kind of medium to bridge that gap between them and actually get people learning from best practices and promote evidence-based decision-making.
So in a sense, we want to almost expect G20 processes, and you can check some, we have some video and graphic explainers out explaining G20 and all its processes and C20 and Y20 and. But really, it's, we need to also case study success.
Yeah, absolutely. Why are we not learning from each other?
Exactly.
Where every country is maybe doing one or two things really well, or a city or a company, and we're not bothering to kind of look at what the leaders have got right and what we can actually learn from them.
Yeah.
It's just a kind of, to be honest, it seems like a bit of a mindless talk shop.
Well, something that was occurring to me a bit earlier, and knowing we have to wrap up now, but I don't think we should miss it, is I think a lot of times media has lost the identity, it's lost its purpose, right? Like, you need a sustainable business model, right? It needs to be able to pay people to do the good work. It needs to pay, if you're printing something physically, you need to pay for that. Publishing, running a website is also not free. So cool, we need to pay for that. But the purpose of media, going back to basically the modern era beginning, it has always been to be a big part of how we engage with our leaders, how we engage society, how we engage with our democracy. And if we instead focus on just the financial side of media, you're missing the point. Like, cool, if you want to make a cool fantasy television show or movie or whatever, sure, that can be entirely financially driven. But the moment it's about how we understand society and how we engage with society and how we change the world, that's, you know, fine, financial sustainability. But at the same time, the mission is not financial sustainability. Mm. The mission is understanding, knowledge, education.
Yeah.
And from what I'm hearing, that's also a big part of what the, and when I say the Progress Playbook's trying to achieve this, it's not an isolation. Mm. It's many voices in a choir. Those other organizations I mentioned earlier, advocacy organizations and comedians actually to some degree are also playing a role in this.
Yeah.
Whether we like it or not, I think people hear their news better from a comedian than they do from a journalist often.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah.
I do think media is in crisis, and I have a lot of sympathy for traditional media companies, but I think the way to win back trust, which has been deeply damaged in traditional media, is to go back to the kind of roots of fact-checking.
Yeah.
So if our Minister of Energy says renewable energy doesn't work and the rest of the world has given up on it, we don't just publish that as the headline and not fact-check it. That is what, unfortunately, we still do. You read it all the time in the news. We'll just sort of say, this is what the energy minister says, and no fact-checking whatsoever. I think that is kind of where traditional media has gone wrong in a very difficult time, and that's accelerated its downfall, which is a big threat and actually needs to be reversed.
I really like that, and I think we're probably going to end off there. And one of the things we always try to do here is talk about what can we do. So we know what we can do in the media industry or in the advocacy industry, but I think as listeners, once again, if you could become an activist, that's a great thing. follow us, subscribe, all those sort of things. You'll find out more about what you can do as an activist. But in relation to media, I think it's one, being more mindful in your curation of sources. Go out of your way to find sources that maybe don't agree with you, but do speak factually. And the second thing is invest. Invest in media. If it's your local newspaper, if it's fine, even if it's a big commercial entity that we've been discussing today, one of those, in some way, invest in media that encourages media to perform its task better, to do the role we need it to do, so that we move forward with education and are able to ask and engage in society to get the positive change we need, whether it's through regarding poverty, inequality, climate change, or any other social movement.
Fully agree. And write a letter to the editor.
The classic.
Write a letter to the editor and demand kind of, you know, fact-checking and demand that newspapers return to their roots, which is being an arbiter of truth.
Thank you so much, Nick, for joining us today. And we're looking forward to being in touch in the future. And we'll definitely link the Progress Playbook and some of the work you guys do in our description below.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for watching this Mobilize podcast. Remember to follow, subscribe, like, and comment.